we are coming off a 30-year period of underinvestment in the means of production. We have underinvested in exploration. We've underinvested in development. We've underinvested in construction. We've underinvested in sustaining capital. At the same time that we have increased the regulation and taxation, the social rents around natural resources, no matter what we do, we will experience broad decreases in supply in the next 10 years.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Last year was a bruising one as both stocks and bonds got clobbered. But there's a silver lining for investors as we enter 2023, and that's silver. Rick Rule, perhaps the most seasoned and respected natural resources investor alive today, is extremely bullish on the precious metals, especially silver, predicting it will be one of the best performing assets of 2023. To find out why, let's ask the man himself. Rick, it's wonderful to see you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Adam, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me back. I always enjoy our sessions.
I do too, Rick. And honestly, the biggest challenge in interviewing you is the fact that you have like three interviews worth of content that we have to try to squeeze into one interview's worth of time. So we're going to do our best here today to get as much as we can on the table here for folks. But I really want to zero in to the particular topic of silver, because you have a silver boot camp event coming up soon. We'll tell people more details about that, but just to get it out there, folks, if you can't watch the whole video right now, just go to wealthion.com/silverbootcamp. You'll get all the details there. All right, but before we get to silver, Rick, let's just jump off at the high level question I like to ask you every time you come on, just to set the stage. What's your current assessment of the global economy in financial markets?
I would say my assessment's mixed. I feel wonderful about the ascent of humankind. I feel wonderful about the distribution of knowledge and responsibility to people in frontier markets that never had the ability to participate anymore. I look at it as an example at the advancement of the private sector in places like Nigeria and Indonesia, and I feel very hopeful for the future of humankind. The problem, Adam, as I see it, is the way we vote collectively.
Okay.
All of the problems that I see, all of them, are a function of people trying to express their will through governments rather than markets. In a market, you have to convince the counterparty. If you have control of a government, you can coerce the counterparty.
Mm-hmm.
And the increasing trend around the world to coercion, as opposed to conversation, is, to me, very alarming. When I look at my own country, the United States, and I see that the government has become a mechanism for enforcing exchange, which is to say a mechanism for defending oneself from one's counterparties while at the same time victimizing them, I get nervous. Aggregate government debt at the federal level exceeds $100 trillion, including off-balance sheet liabilities. And we propose to service this debt with a budget that's in deficit $2 trillion a year. I also see, as a possible consequence of 40 years of negative interest rates and 40 years of quantitative easing, which, by the way, Adam, if you did it, would be called counterfeiting.
Mm-hmm.
I see the chance, not the certainty, but the chance of a sort of a restorative recession. We need to wring the excesses out of the economy that we have wrung into it over the last 40 years. Perhaps we can save and grow our way out of it. But that probability is not consistent with my reading of history. So it may be that we face, for the first time in a long time, a synchronized global recession, which would, I suspect, be unpleasant for everyone. What I can guarantee, Adam, is that the next 10 years is going to feature a lot more dislocation and a lot more volatility than the last 10 years. Your listeners need to make volatility their friend. They need to learn how to use it, or they are going to be used by it. You may remember our earlier interviews, Adam, where my tagline was always, you either will be a contrarian or you will become a victim.
Mm-hmm.
In a period of increased volatility and perhaps increased cyclicality, that warning becomes more prescient, I think, than ever.
All right. Wonderful setting of the table here. And Rick, I presume one of the reasons why you're so concerned about the coercion, the top-down coercion of governments, is that it really breaks price discovery, or maybe strangles price discovery. And as a result, you get mispricing and malinvestment.
Really three things. The solvency of society, the fact that we spend our seed corn, is problematic. Governments, at least governments in democracy, favor the majority. And the majority are spenders, not savers. But societies don't get rich by spending more than they save.
Right.
So in the first instance, coercion becomes a way that spenders declare war and win on savers, to the detriment, ultimately, of everybody. The second thing is precisely what you suggest. The rational allocation of goods and services doesn't come from the top down. It isn't decided for us by Congress. It goes from the bottom up, where people spend the proceeds of their labor and their efforts and their intelligence on goods and services that matter to them, not to the big thinkers. And when government imposes itself on top, you ultimately lower the collective utility, because the decisions are made on a group rather than an individual level. And it's impossible for Congress to know what I want and what you want, or what any of your listeners want or need. The third thing is that the ultimate expression of coercion is war. And I'm anti-war. It is highly unlikely that, left to their own devices, Russian factory workers and peasants would have crossed the border in Ukraine. It is highly unlikely, left to their own volition, that the Ukrainians would have posed any threat whatsoever to Russia. In my youth, it's highly unlikely that a bunch of American college students would have voluntarily mobilized themselves to invade Vietnam. Mm-hmm. These things, wars, require a belief in coercion and a belief in government. I'm pro-market, I'm anti-war, and I'm pro-savings. The consequence of that, I guess, is manifested by my political and economic beliefs.
Right, right. Okay. All right. So those are very big, and I can't argue with any of them, but very big warning flags that you're waving here. In terms of sort of your area of expertise, right, which is natural resources investing, I think a lot of these things manifest in certain cases, mispricing of assets at times. And also, I think they also can oftentimes result in underinvestment, right? And I know that, having you know, you've appeared in this program many times, Rick, and you've really eloquently explained how, in a lot of really essential natural resources, especially energy, which sort of makes everything possible, we have a real, you know, have had a real drought of capital investment in critical areas that even if, you know, we have no disruptions going forward, we're going to have some pretty massive shortfalls to deal with. And that's if everything goes as best we can hope from here, which it probably won't, for a lot of the reasons that you mentioned. So this is my segue into my next question, which is, why is it such a good time right now to invest in natural resources?
Well, I think you led into it well. There are two themes around natural resources. One is demographic. There are 8 billion of us on Earth, and more being born every day. And one of the unsung successes of humankind is the incredible advancement that we have made in increasing the material living standards of the poorest of the poor. And Adam, I believe and pray that this will continue. Mm-hmm. When the bottom 3 billion people on the demographic curve get more wealth, the things that they buy are commodity centric. People who have no things, when they get money, buy things.
Buy things, yep.
Adam, you already have too many things. So when you get more wealth, you buy services, or you buy some little technological gizmo for $1,000 that has basically no things in it. But when the bottom third, materially speaking, of humankind gets more money, they replace a thatch roof with a metal roof. They replace mud walls with cinder block. They upgrade from barefoot to tennis shoe to bicycle to 50cc motorcycle. And this is happening around the world. At the same time that demand for resources is increasing, at the same time that the geopolitics has suggested that various societies need to compete for resources, we are coming off a 30-year period of underinvestment in the means of production. We have underinvested in exploration. We've underinvested in development. We've underinvested in construction. We've underinvested in sustaining capital. At the same time that we have increased the regulation and taxation, the social rents around natural resources, no matter what we do, we will experience broad decreases in supply in the next 10 years. The price impact can be mitigated by a recession. If we have a recession, you can have falling supply if you have falling demand and you don't get rising prices.
Right.
Ex a recession, I think that we're looking at sharply higher prices for natural resources. Understand that natural resources across the board are historically cheap in constant dollars going back 50 years. They will revert to mean. And reverting to mean will be very unpleasant for people who aren't prepared for it, and probably very pleasant for those listeners of yours who are forward-thinking enough to organize their portfolio in a way that takes advantage of this trend.
All right. And you said, use the term X a recession. Assuming for a moment that we are entering a recession right now, which there are lots of indicators that we very well may be, I would presume, looking through your eyes, so correct me if this is wrong, but I would presume that you would think if a recession did bring demand down, and if that in the near term brought the prices of a lot of these commodity producers down as well, that this might be like a generational amazing entry point for capital in this space.
That is precisely what I'm thinking. I am not a good enough economic forecaster that I can tell you that we are going to head into a recession. I can tell you this, if we have a circumstance over 10 years where demand for resources greatly outstrips supply, if you have the opportunity to play that thesis in the near term with people believing because of pricing signals that a different outcome is coming, in other words, were the shares of major resource producers, major oil companies, major mining companies to decline by 30% or 50%, you would have precisely that generational opportunity that faced people in 1968, 1969, and 1970. I'm not saying that that's going to happen, but I wouldn't mind one more mega market in my life, Adam.
Good. I hope you get it, my friend, and that we get to participate alongside you. Just because you use the term major there, for folks that aren't as experienced as you in natural resources investing, painting with a very broad brush here, but there's largely two types of companies. There are the big, the larger players, the ones that are much more sustainable. They tend to have positive cash flows that are dependable. They tend to hopefully be profitable, whatnot. Then you have the miners, which are much smaller companies. They generally take on much more risky ventures. They're the explorers, the developers. It's funny, I've interviewed you on this program enough, Rick, to see times where you have said, hey, the majors are cheap enough that the risk return, you know, is best just to sit in the safety of the majors and just, you know, ride the overall, you know, prospects of the market. I've also seen you at times say, hey, the pendulum shifted now. The more junior companies seem to, you know, really be poised. Given your kind of current outlook here, do you have a bias one way or the other right now towards majors or minors?
We're in the middle right now, and it really depends on the investors. People who aren't in the space at all need to play the beta. They need to buy the biggest and the best producers. By the way, they're benefiting from gargantuan dividends relative to other sources of income stream. But for people who don't have resources in their portfolio, they need to invest before they speculate. They need to devote probably 80% of their portfolio, in most cases, to the biggest and best natural resource companies in the world. That doesn't mean that for people who are prepared to work and take risks, that they shouldn't speculate. All of the money that I personally now invest, conservatively, I made by wild speculation. So now I got very lucky and I worked very hard. And I would suggest that the sort of distribution in the portfolio between beta, which is to say the big companies, and alpha, which is to say the small companies, is very much a function of how hard the investor is prepared to work, how much they're willing to understand the companies in their portfolio. And by the way, how willing they are psychologically to stomach volatility. Mm-hmm. Some of these juniors can fall by 15% in a day for no reason except that one senior portfolio manager had to rebalance. Prices are set on the margin. And if you aren't psychologically prepared to endure 15% swings in the share price, the juniors are not for you. Stick to the seniors.
All right. Very well said. And just underscore this, that I mean, Rick, you have been a very successful investor in your life, but you have put in the hard work and stacked the odds to your advantage, because you're the kind of guy that has a deep background in this industry, would get on a plane, go into the Amazon, you know, look at the mine, talk to the management directly that you had a relationship with. So my point is, you know, in your career, you've been able to gather more intelligence than the average armchair investor here, right? And I think in this resource space, unless you're somebody who can kind of do that on your own, which I think very few people in the world really have the ability to do that, you're much better off partnering with an analyst who does do that. And there are people out there, you and your past organizations, and even some of your current endeavors, Rick, you know, you still do the work, and you have a newsletter, or you have some, you know, events that you put on, et cetera, where you're shining a spotlight on the prospects, the projects that you think are, you know, have the highest upside, and you explain why. And we're going to talk a bit about your upcoming Silver Bootcamp, where you're doing that specifically for companies in the silver space. But I just want to underscore for folks that this is a highly volatile sector, like Rick just said, and to really win in it, I mean, you have to, the people with the best intelligence win, right? And so if you sitting in your armchair, you know, looking at these stocks once or twice a month, don't have the ability to do what these top experts do, then find a good top expert and hit your star to their wagon.
Understand, though, that you must be the boss of your expert. You have to have enough knowledge, and you got to be constant enough in your knowledge that, first of all, you select your expert well, and that you ask him or her the right questions and know how to interpret them. That's precisely, frankly, why I do these interviews, to equip people with the knowledge to invest and speculate successfully, and why I do the boot camp. The idea that you can rely on experts, that you can obviate your own responsibility to your own portfolio, is very dangerous. Very recently, the world experienced a debacle that put this into view, which was FTX. Did the regulators catch it? No. Did the big investors like Sequoia catch it? No. Did they do due diligence? Obviously not, because there was nothing to do due diligence on. Yeah. Did they take the notes from the board of directors meetings? No, because there weren't any. Did they review the financials? No, because there were no financials. So it's very important that the people who are listening to this interview, whether or not they intend to speculate or invest in silver or in any other function, do not obviate responsibility of their portfolio by experts, but rather use their own knowledge, do their own work to utilize the information that experts offer up, which can be very valuable. It's important that you educate before you speculate.
Very well said. All right. Well, look, I'm winnowing my way to silver here, but I couldn't have the Rick Rule on the program and not ask him just really quickly to dial through some of the other sectors in the natural resources space before we do our deep dive in silver. So this is unfair, Rick, but I'm just going to ask if you can maybe give like a 60-second, generalized outlook to the following categories. Energy right now, what do you think of its prospects as we look forward in 2023?
Maybe
had a big run in 2022.
Maybe in the very near term lower. But in the course of a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, much higher. The big thinkers suggest to you that peak oil demand will be 2025. I think it'll be 2045. And that's peak demand. Demand will tail off from there. Meanwhile, the energy industry is underinvesting in sustaining capital on a worldwide basis by $1 billion a day. They are underinvesting by $365 billion a year. And if you don't make the sustaining capital investments, you can't maintain production. OPEC has suggested that they might relax their quotas. The reason for that is the companies can't produce to match their current quotas. You know, I mean, the constraint in supply has nothing to do with political will. It has everything to do with an underinvestment in the means of production. This is silly stuff. Did you know, Adam, I love arithmetic, by the way. The world has now invested $4.6 trillion in alternative energies. And I believe in alternative energies. They've invested $4.6 trillion in alternative energies over 30 years. And they've reduced the market share of fossil fuels in energy from 82% all the way down to 81%.
Oh, my goodness.
They've reduced the market share by 1% after a $4.6 trillion expenditure. Now, we have 1 billion people on Earth who have no access to electricity, 2 billion people on Earth who have access only to intermittent or unaffordable electricity. You're going to tell people in Malawi to spend $1 billion that they don't have to put up a solar array, which might be 30% efficient? It's not going to happen. So the energy business in the 3-year time frame, the 5-year time frame, the 10-year time frame is a no-brainer. What'll happen in the 90-day time frame? I have no earthly idea, and frankly, no rational care.
Great, because you think the tailwind is going to be so strong and so prolonged, doesn't matter what the next couple of quarters do. Look, on the energy side, I know I'd get a lot of angry comments if I didn't ask you just real quick to talk about uranium. And actually, I believe the last boot camp that you produced was on uranium.
Yeah.
That was the topic more than any other that people were saying, hey, Rick's coming on, ask him about uranium.
Uranium's a no-brainer. Again, I'm not trying to say it's going to be a no-brainer in 2023. I have no earthly idea. I think 2023 is going to be the year, because I've said for 6 or 7 years that the most important near-term determinant of the uranium price is the pace of Japanese restarts. Public opinion in Japan has gone from 70% opposed to nuclear to 61% in favor of nuclear. The political class in Japan has always favored nuclear for strategic and economic reasons. So the obstacles are out of the way for the restart of the Japanese nuclear fleet. The restart of the Japanese nuclear fleet will generate between 12 and 15 million pounds of demand in the near term. There are other things that will drive demand in the long term, SMRs, small modular reactors.
Yeah.
A lot's been made of that. That's going to drive demand 10 years from now, 15 years from now. The pace of Japanese restarts, that's going to drive demand in 2023 and 2024. And by the way, that demand is going to come into a market that is already larger in terms of annual consumption than pre-Fukushima, which is to say the world is now using more uranium than it was before the shutdown. And Japanese demand comes on top of that. The second thing is that my former employer, Sprott, with the aid of many of your viewers, marched into the market and bought 55 million pounds of uranium. That 55 million pounds, the supply overhang, went to supply heaven.
Right.
This stuff doesn't get sold, it doesn't get burned, it doesn't get used. That isn't to say that if the uranium price were to triple and somebody were to make a tender, as an example, a well above market tender, so that it was in the interest of all concerned to liquidate that trust, that that wouldn't happen. But the truth is that in the near term, 55 million pounds of supply went to supply heaven at precisely the same time that demand in the near term is vastly exceeding new mined supply. Two, there are geopolitical concerns around uranium in the sense that while the Russians aren't particularly important uranium suppliers, they provide about 40% of the enrichment, re-enrichment, and reprocessing capacity in the world, which means that we will be inefficient consumers of uranium and inefficient recyclers of uranium until the Russian-Ukrainian conflict ends.
Okay, and I feel like I could talk about this just this topic with you for the rest of the conversation, but because you brought up the Russian conflict in Ukraine, not only the point that you just made there, but we've seen so many other countries impacted by the shockwaves of the disruptions that invasion has created that, you know, in particular Europe, right? I mean, they've gone back to burning way more fossil fuels than they were before, right? And so even though they have the green, you know, strategy, they basically had to completely shift in reverse just to, you know, keep the country running, basically. And so have those shockwaves caused a political reevaluation of nuclear?
Not yet. I think that you're seeing a groundswell of support among the citizenry for rational energy policy. By the way, I'm not suggesting that reducing emissions isn't a rational energy policy. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that we have to get from here to there, particularly among the big thinkers of the World Economic Forum types. There is still a very strong anti-nuclear bent, but it's worthwhile to note that the co-founder of Greenpeace is an example. Has become a stalwart supporter of nuclear power.
Right.
Nations that believe that they're rich enough that they won't be impacted can still take odd positions. As an example, Norway has decided that they're going to subsidize the switch to all electric vehicles in 5 years. They're going to do that, of course, from the revenues that they get from offshore oil and gas production. The Germans, too, decided that they would rely on solar way far in the north where the sun doesn't shine. I note very recently that the Germans are knocking down a wind farm to expand a coal mine. I guess that's what happens when perception collides with reality. Two, you are seeing circumstances around Europe in particular where the economic dislocation that has to do with the triumph of narrative over policies is getting in the way of the benefits that citizens expect from their government. I'm looking in particular at France, where various types of, quote, investments undertaken by the government are beginning to crowd out the benefits expected by the pensioners in France. The whole circumstance where government decides on behalf of everyone lasts as long as everyone agrees with the decisions made by government.
Right.
But when the decisions become completely unaffordable, we saw recently in Sri Lanka as an example, where a broke country decided as a consequence of its leader's preference that all food production in the country was going to be organic. What that resulted in 1 year was a failed harvest and starvation in a country that had been a food exporter. Hmm. It takes real skill, the type of skill only exhibited by governments to cause this to occur. I saw the same thing happen in Chile 45 years ago when Allende came to power. It took him 3 years of socialism to take a food exporter into a food importer. And I think that the question you asked before I went on this rant really has to do with the fact that some of the decisions that the big thinkers are making are narrative-based and not based on either economic reality or the true wishes of the people who are governed.
Got it. And if I could sort of interpret from what you're saying, we're not seeing the shifting of the political winds yet, but you're seeing a shifting of the winds on the public sentiment, which will probably likely eventually be reflected in the political landscape as they throw the bums out and elect people that have a more sane energy policy mindset.
I'd love to come back in and talk about this. There are probably 20 examples that are illustrative and hilarious.
Okay. Hilarious. I'd love to dig into them with you, but I can't because we still have so much more to go through. But you can't. We'll have you back on to talk about it. Don't worry about that. All right. So that was energy. I caused you to talk about that way more than we had time for. So just real quick, agriculture. You just made a couple of references to it, but certainly, you know, the ag market, the ag commodity market got really disrupted last year. Do you see it? What do you see as its prospects from here?
I don't know if you remember, but I think the first interview that you and I ever did was probably half about ag. Mm-hmm. The fact that soft commodities in particular were so cheap that they had to rebound. That's over. I mean, they've rebounded. Partially it was geopolitics, but mostly it was just a dead cat bounce. They were unsustainably low. So soft commodity prices don't have to go up, although I'm not saying that they won't go up. In the U.S., at least, farm gate incomes are in very good condition. The farmers' balance sheets are in good condition. The investment strategy that I talked to you 4 or 5 years ago, which is to say buy high-quality U.S. farmland, was doubled.
It worked. Yep, those strategies worked.
That game may be over. The idea that people would invest in inputs, which is to say nitrogenous fertilizer, NPK, things like that, that's a very, very, very relevant theme. And I'm not trying to say either that people should ignore investing in farmland, but the people who should invest in farmland now are people who have the ability to add value, just as the people who invest in developed real estate now in the face of rising real interest rates and low cap rates can't be passive real estate investors. They have to add value. The same with farming.
You can't win by flipping anymore. You've got to actually add value.
Easy days are over, sadly.
Okay. And then last, before we get to the main event, base metals.
You know, base metals, particularly if you extend it to electric metals, the sort of cobalts, nickels, coppers of the world, we have underinvested grossly in the means of production around these things. I mean, grossly. Never mind the electric vehicle, the electrification of the bottom third of humanity. This is a no-brainer theme. In copper, as an example, if you look at where we get our copper now, I'm sort of a metaphor for the copper mine, which is to say past my prime. I'm 70 years of age. Chuquicamata, the biggest copper mine in the world, is 110. Grasberg is 60. Bingham Canyon is 150. We are living on deposits that were discovered 60 or 70 years ago, built 40 or 50 years ago, and they're way, way, way past their prime. Meanwhile, more and more people are using more and more copper. Could the copper price go lower as a consequence of a recession before it goes higher? Yes. But will it go higher in nominal and real dollar terms? Absolutely, positively. Because if not, Adam, the lights will go out. Copper gets electricity from point A to point B. And once it gets to point B, it makes it usable. To the extent that the world is going to continue to enjoy the benefits of electricity, the copper price has to go up. Does the iron price have to go up? I'm not so sure of that. That really depends on the pace of Chinese recovery. But when we look through a lot of the base metals and a lot of the electrical metals, the copper, the nickel, the cobalt, the tin, we have underinvested as a species in the means of production of those commodities for a very long time, while at the same time enjoying their low prices relative to other economic inputs. That party's coming to a halt.
Well, Rick, look, I've interviewed you enough to know that when you make a bold statement like that, it has a very high probability of coming true in the future. Another thing I love about you as an interviewee, Rick, is that you anticipate the question that I was going to ask next. So it's great when you answer a question, you answer like five that I was going to ask you. All right. So that was the base metals. Now let's get into the precious metals. You've recently predicted that gold and silver will be top performers for 2023. Why are they moving to the top pole position in your outlook for commodities?
And I probably should say it might be 2024. I believe it's 2023, but it's important that people adjust their time preferences to what's real. Let me just say this. Investors, all investors around the world are underweight precious metals precisely at the time that they ought to be overweight precious metals. So let's talk about the why before we talk about the when. We do that?
Great.
The first is geopolitics, which is on everybody's mind. In particular, the weaponization of the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar trying to export its policy preferences to other places in the world by utilizing its reserve currency status and SWIFT to punish other people for taking what we believe are un-American views. Many people in the world resent the extraterritorial imposition of U.S. values on their cultures. Other cultures, Iran, Russia, China, India, Brazil, Mexico, feel, Saudi Arabia for that matter, feel overtly threatened by the United States. And the idea that they would denominate their trade and give sovereignty to a country that imposes its will on them means that they are looking for means of settlement outside the U.S. dollar. Much has been made about new cryptocurrencies, which is to say like the BRIC currency. I don't think that's a threat at all. My friend Doug Casey says the U.S. dollar is an IOU nothing. The euro is a who owes you nothing. And the BRIC is a nobody owes you nothing. The truth is that as little as these countries trust us, they trust each other even less.
Correct.
And I believe that gold, which isn't a promise to pay, but rather payment itself, will be a great beneficiary of the disintermediation of world trade away from the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. By the way, I think the U.S. dollar will be the reserve currency 20 years from now. I just think its market share will be less than it is today. But let's stop blaming the rest of the world. Let's look at the United States in terms of why precious metals will do well. The debasement of the medium of exchange, which is to say the U.S. dollar, and by proxy, the U.S. Treasury market, is insane. First of all, let's look at the creditor. $32 trillion in recourse on balance sheet liabilities, $26 trillion net of the Fed's balance sheet. $100 trillion in net present value, not nominal values, net present value of off-balance sheet liabilities, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, veterans benefits, federal pension trust funds, $100 trillion. So collectively at the federal level, we're upside down over $125 trillion. And we propose to service this debt with a budget that's in deficit $2 trillion a year. The arithmetic is farcical. It's totally farcical. But just for fun, let's look at the yield. Let's look at the best historic savings instrument in the world. The deepest and most liquid is the U.S. 10-year Treasury. Let's look at the value proposition for the greatest competition gold has. The thing yields savers 3.5% in a currency that the Congressional Budget Office, not some cranky old libertarian, suggests is depreciating the value of the dollar by 7% a year. So the U.S. government absolutely positively guarantees that if you lend them money for 10 years, they'll cost you 3.5% of your purchasing power compounded every year for 10 years. And you know what, Adam? I believe them. That's what they'll do. Jim Grant calls this return-free risk.
Yeah.
So think about the fact that the principal competitor for gold and silver is return-free risk. And think in your own mind whether that's a mountain too high to climb. But it gets worse or better, depending on your point of view. Inflation and negative real interest rates obliterate the long bond market. And the long bond market is an enormous market, particularly relative to gold. Adam, imagine yourself as running a big university endowment. You're managing $30 billion, and you're going to look after the institution and the students 20 years from now and 25 years from now. And your portfolio is 60% long bonds, which have treated you very well for 40 years with declining real interest rates. Low interest rates, negative real interest rates, but rising interest rates obliterate the long bond market.
Right.
On the one hand, as interest rates rise, the capitalized value of distributions falls. So a 10-year treasury, which was bought to yield 2, is less valued than a 10-year treasury, which is bought to yield 3.5. So the capitalized value of the bonds in these portfolios falls, which means that the contributions have to rise, but the legislatures won't contribute more.
Yeah.
At the same time that that happens, the continued negative real interest rate, the spread between the interest yield and inflation, means that the yield on the portfolio becomes insufficient to meet the obligations that that portfolio was set up for. So you, now, rather than being an interviewer and an investor, you're a portfolio manager for a big university. The first thing that happens is that 60% of your portfolios are in bonds. As a consequence of the interest rate rise, your portfolio loses 25% of its capitalized value. Mm-hmm. And the legislature is unwilling to give you any more money. You are making your actuarial assumptions on the fact that over the last 40 years, you've generated an 8% annual yield. The problem is that because of writing down your bonds and perhaps problems with regards to the S&P, this year you're down 15%. Now, you don't have an immediate problem because of actuarial fraud. You are allowed to carry the bonds at their par value, assuming that you pretend that you're going to hold them to maturity because they're regarded as having no risk. But you have a real risk. You have a real risk because the bond yield that you will enjoy will be insufficient to maintain the needs of the university 20 years from now. Your only choice is to begin to disintermediate, which is an economist word for sell, some of your bond portfolio and go into another asset class.
Right. And or this to is make where sure gets, you pass the torch to someone else before 20 years is up and let it be their problem. But yes.
This is where it gets back to gold. And I use gold as a catch-all for precious metals, including silver. The market share of precious metals relative to other savings and investment classes in the United States currently is less than 0.5%.
All right. Wow.
Down from a 40-year mean of 2%. And by the way, an estimated market share in 1981, its peak, in excess of 5%. I'm not suggesting that the world is going to sell all their long bonds and go into gold. I'm suggesting that the market share of precious metals will return to its 40-year mean, which is to say 2%. And if that occurs, demand for precious metals will quadruple. And that's what I think is going to happen. It's precisely what I think is going to happen. Prices are set on the margin. And I believe that that will be very, very good for precious metals prices. Will it occur in 2023? I don't know. Will it occur? I've never seen math lie.
Well, that's what I love about this is it's a math argument. You mentioned earlier that you love arithmetic. You know, if we can get the laws of the universe on our side, then our chances for probability go up, obviously. All right. So I imagine a key factor in that endowment portfolio manager's mind is, okay, what do I think inflation is going to do from here, right? So if he thinks it's going to be persistently higher than it's been, it makes that problem even worse, right? And so I guess one question is do you think we enjoyed a lot of disinflation over the past couple of decades. Do you see us as sort of being in a new era here? And obviously, if you do, even mildly, if you're that bond manager, you're right. You got to figure out where to put money into. And so this story becomes a story of capital flows.
I guess there's a couple outcomes that investors need to consider. The first would be inflation destruction through a recession. Mm-hmm. We have learned over the last 40 years that the expected policy tool in an economic slowdown is artificially low interest rates and quantitative easing, which is to say counterfeiting, which while in the near term of a recession would be bad for precious metals prices, in the long term, the policy prescription would be great for precious metals prices.
Right.
But I think what you really need to look at is the war on savers by spenders, which is to say that the politically favored outcome is negative real interest rates. My suspicion is that because decisions are made politically rather than economically, that we will persist for many years in having rates of return on savings that are below the rate of inflation. We've gotten away with it for the last 40 years because we came from a period of such high interest rates.
Right.
And for other reasons, globalization, a whole bunch of other reasons. But I think that party's over. And I think that as long as budget deficits and negative real interest rates persist, that precious metals have a very high probability of reverting to mean.
All right. So now we're getting into the main event. So I'm going to ask you real quick to just share any parts of your outlook for gold that you'd like to that we haven't talked about yet before we get to silver. I hate to ask people for price targets because that's
there's
a lot of sensationalism that goes in there. But you talked about the fact that capital flowing into gold might quadruple because of this factor that you talked about. I can't imagine that would happen without having a pretty substantial impact positively on the price of gold.
That's my belief. And I believe that even if I'm wrong, investors would be well advised to insure against the contingency that I'm right. It doesn't take very much gold in your portfolio to hedge against the sins that happen elsewhere in your portfolio. And to the extent that investors don't hold gold, and by gold, I mean physical gold or physical proxies in their portfolio, those people are in effect uninsured. which I believe, unless they are extremely rich and can self-insure, is very stupid. I don't think that in the first instance, people should buy gold just because they think it's going to go up. I think they should buy it as a way to maintain their purchasing power over the rest of their useful lives.
Yeah.
Buy it and, in fact, hope it goes wrong. It goes down, because gold is insurance in its purest form, a medium of exchange and a store of value.
So, Rick, would you say that just like the market fell in love with the Fed put over the past 15 years?
Yep.
Are you saying that investors should fall in love with the gold put going forward here?
Fall in love might be the wrong phrase. Do you love life insurance? Love home insurance? I think it's the responsibility of a mature adult to organize his or her life in a way that will give them the best outcome. And I think gold is an absolute component of that. I have no idea what's going to happen in terms of my mass psychology. I'm talking about your listeners taking action themselves to secure their well-being.
Great. And the insurance analogy is a great one. I just, in the heat of the moment, listening to you speak, I was like, that's basically what gold is, though. It's a put on your purchasing, the purchasing power of your capital. Right.
Exactly what it is. Now, beyond saving, beyond insurance, if gold does well, the major gold stocks should do very well. So an investor, somebody that's different than a saver, should look at the senior gold stocks. And the speculator, by the way, I am one, should look at the junior gold stocks, but understand that that risk stack involves a work stack. So if you aren't willing to work, just save. Don't invest. If you're willing to work a little, invest. If you're willing to work a lot, then of course, speculate. And that brings us to silver, which is to say the ultimate speculative asset class, I would suggest in natural resources, but particularly in precious metals. And one of the reasons why I look at it so favorably.
Well, that's a perfect segue. So set the table for us, Rick. Why does silver have your full attention right now?
The honest answer to that is greed.
Our interview with Rick will continue over in part two, which will be released on this channel tomorrow as soon as we're finished editing it. To be notified when it comes out, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already by clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And be sure to hit the like button too while you're down there. And don't forget to go check out the details for Rick's upcoming Silver Bootcamp on February 11th. To learn more about the event, as well as how to register for it, go to wealthion.com/silverbootcamp. And finally, if the challenging macro outlook that Rick has detailed in this interview has you feeling a little vulnerable about the prospects for your wealth, then consider scheduling a free, no-strings-attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help manage your wealth, keeping in mind the trends, risks, and opportunities that Rick has mentioned here. Just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set one up for you. Okay, I'll see you next over in part two of our interview with the great Rick Rule.